and a traitor.
But Benton pursued his independent and increasingly lonely course. He would not go over to the Whig Party, whose petty politicians, he said, are no more able to comprehend me than a rabbit, which breeds 12 times a year, could comprehend the gestation of an elephant, which carries 2 years. Nor would he seek financial aid from the lobbyists swarming over Washington, telling the agent for one group seeking a ship subsidy that the only condition upon which he would lift a finger to help was, when the vessels are finished, they will be used to take all such damned rascals as you, sir, out of the country. Nor would he make peace with the Missouri political chiefs. Only at home was Benton at peace with the world. As his daughter, Jessie Benton Fremont, wrote in her memoirs, "To him, home brought the strength of peace and repose, and he never suffered the outside public atmosphere of strife to enter there." But in the Senate he was alone, hard and merciless, with piles of books and papers heaped on his desk, speaking frequently to nearly empty galleries and an indifferent chamber. Benton poured forth thousands of statistics, classical illustrations, and magnificent metaphors upon colleagues with far more formal schooling and originality of thought. But no amount of acquired information, bulldog persistence, or the ferocious egotism could save Thomas Hart Benton from the tidal wave that engulfed the Senate and his state over one burning issue, slavery. Unfortunately, until it was too late, Benton refused to recognize slavery as a major issue, believed that the Missouri Compromise of 1820 had taken it out of politics, and refused to debate it on the Senate floor. One of the few members of Congress who still brought his slaves with him to his Washington household, he nevertheless was equally opposed to the abolitionists and the secessionists, to the permanent extension of this evil into new territory by the South, and to the partisan exploitation of its miseries by Northern agitators. Above all, he was most distressed about the fact that the issue was constantly raised by both sides as a barrier to Western expansion and the admission of new states to the Union. The beginning of Benton's end came on February 19, 1847. John C. Calhoun read to a worried Senate his famous resolutions, insisting that Congress had no right to interfere with the development of slavery in the territories. Calhoun called for an immediate vote, and in the momentary confusion that followed, he was angrily amazed to see the massive and stately Benton rising from his chair, his face flashing with obvious contempt for Calhoun, the resolutions, and his own political fate. "Mr. Benton, Mr. President, we have some business to transact, and I do not intend to avoid business for a string of abstractions." "Mr. Calhoun, I certainly suppose the senator from Missouri, the representative of a slaveholding state, would have supported these resolutions." "Mr. Benton, the senator knows very well from my whole course in public life that I would never leave public business to take up firebrands to set the world on fire." "Mr. Calhoun, then I shall know where to find the gentleman." "Mr. Benton, I shall be found in the right place, on the side of my country in the Union." This answer, wrote Benton in later years, given on that day and on that spot, is one of the incidents of his life which Mr. Benton will wish posterity to remember. When Calhoun initiated a series of secret nightly meetings of congressmen from slave states, Benton refused to have anything to do with it. When Calhoun's colleague from South Carolina challenged him to a duel, he refused to have anything to do with him. When he was warned not to deliver his great eulogy in appreciation of that foe of slavery, John Quincy Adams, he refused to heed such warnings. And finally, when in 1848, the slavery issue split the Democratic Party at its convention, Benton, deploring the split and denying the importance of the issue, refused to support either camp actively. He was now a man without a party, a politician without a recognized platform, and a senator without a constituency. The noose was set early in 1849. Calhoun, successful in obtaining adoption of his resolutions by several southern legislatures, denounced Benton to his Missouri enemies as one false to the South for the last 10 years. His will be the fate of all traitors. By an overwhelming margin, the Missouri legislature adopted Calhoun's resolutions, expressed Missouri's desire to cooperate with other slaveholding states, and instructed her senators to vote accordingly. Determined to see the legislature's resolutions withdrawn or repudiated, Benton launched an aggressive tour of his hostile state. pouring out his taunting sarcasm in short, bombastic thunderbolts of gigantic rage, hate and ridicule day after day, in town after town, he assailed his opponents and their policies with bitter invective. His overbearing and merciless roughness, personal vindictiveness, and uncompromising enmity drove away many whose support he might otherwise have won by conciliation. He began his address to crowded meetings with, "My friends," and in that term I comprehend those who come to hear the truth and to believe it, none others. In one town, spotting from the platform three of his enemies sitting quietly in his audience, while he characterized their resolutions as fungus cancers, he caustically referred to them by name, as demure as three prostitutes at a christening. When his attention was called to the criticism of a distinguished opponent, he lashed back, "Send him word that Benton says he lied from the bottom of his belly to the root of his tongue." And when, upon his ignoring the greeting of a former friend who had disapproved of his course, that unfortunate gentleman bowed and reminded him of his name, Benton coldly replied, "Sir, Benton once knew a man by that name, but he is dead. Yes, sir, he is dead." But Benton's turbulent tour could not stem a tide much greater than any one man or any single state. At its close, confident at least in his outward appearance, Benton addressed a letter to the people of Missouri. "I know of no cause for this conspiracy against me, except that I am the natural enemy of all rotten politicians. I am for the Union as it is, and for that cause Mr. Calhoun denounced me for a traitor to the South, the signal to all his followers in Missouri to go to work upon me. The conspiracy is now established." But he could not shame his enemies into submission, and when Congress reassembled, Calhoun was successful in forcing the Democratic caucus to strip Benton of all his committees except foreign affairs. Even his gigantic ego could not have hidden from Thomas Hart Benton the unmistakable fact that this was his last term. As the contest for the state legislature that would name his successor raged in Missouri, Senator Benton stood fast by his post in Washington, outspoken to the end in his condemnation of the views his constituents now embraced, now isolated from his political friends in the West and South, and yet maintaining his distaste for the abolitionists, whom he held equally responsible for splitting the Union, Benton steered an extraordinarily independent course in his vituperative attacks on Clay's compromise. The so-called compromise, in Benton's opinion, was a hollow sham containing two generous concessions to the secessionists and unnecessarily involving California. To extend the slavery line of the Missouri Compromise into California and thus split the state, or to delay its admission by tying it to this omnibus bill, was reprehensible to Benton, the father-in-law of Colonel John Fremont, hero of California's exploration and development. What if California's admission were prevented by the failure of the compromise, he asked. During the course of the year, still another melodramatic event termed the greatest indignity the Senate had ever suffered served to show the bitter feelings of the South toward Benton. The peppery Senator Henry Foote of Mississippi, no blind follower of Calhoun but suspected by Benton of helping plot his defeat in Missouri, took the floor on several occasions to abuse Benton's position in a coarse manner, exceeding even the Missourian's own rhetorical excesses. Taunting him with his approaching defeat in Missouri and stinging under Benton's counterattack, Foote ridiculed Benton as one shielded by his age and shielded by his own established cowardice. Finally, Benton announced that if the Senate failed to protect him from such false and cowardly attacks, he intended to protect himself, cost what it may. On April 17th, in the midst of another verbal assault upon him by Foote, Benton advanced toward the Mississippian, then turned back at a colleague's restraining touch. Suddenly Foote whipped out a pistol and pointed it at Benton, who dramatically threw open his coat and cried, "I have no pistol, let him fire! Let the assassin fire!" No one fired. The Senate was shocked, although its special committee on censure barely rapped the knuckles of the two participants, but verbal assaults between the two did not cease. Benton's vote against dividing California was his last act of importance in the Senate. In January 1851, climaxing a bitter 12-day struggle among its three distinct parties, Benton Democrats, anti-Benton Democrats, and Whigs. The Missouri legislature on its 40th ballot elected a Whig. After 30 years of outstanding statesmanship in the Senate of the United States, Thomas Hart Benton was ignominiously dismissed from the service and called home. Undismayed and still stubbornly refusing to follow the easy path to a graceful and popular political retirement, Benton fought to return to Congress the following year as a representative from St. Louis. His campaign, according to the opposition New Orleans Crescent, spared no public or personal denunciation. He exhausted every expletive of abuse. He ransacked the entire range of the English language for terms of scorn and derision. Elected in one final burst of personal popularity, he promptly threw to the winds all chances for future re-election by delivering one of his most memorable and one of his most vituperative speeches in opposition to the chief measure of his party, the Kansas-Nebraska Bill. With violent invective, he denounced provisions repealing his cherished Missouri Compromise and pleaded for a national outlook. Soundly defeated for re-election in 1854 and grieved by the death of his beloved wife, Benton was not yet ready to submit. In vain, he sought re-election to the Senate in 1855 and, at the age of 74, made one last hopeless race for governor in 1856. Jessie Benton Fremont revealed in her memoirs that her courageous father, suffering from what he knew to be a fatal throat cancer, could speak in public only by maintaining absolute silence for several days in advance. Even then, his throat bled during and following his still ferocious speeches. Yet he traveled more than 1,200 miles in a desperate speaking tour to defeat the Whig and anti-Benton Democratic candidates. And he returned home, defeated but proud, to complete his monumental historical works. He died while still hard at work, using an amanuensis when his feeble hands could no longer grasp a pen. But even in death and defeat, Thomas Hart Benton was victorious, for his voice from the past on behalf of Union was one of the deciding factors that prevented Missouri from yielding to all the desperate efforts to drive her into secession along with her sister slave states. Sam Houston. The first rays of dawn were streaking into the ill-lit Senate chamber of 1854 as one final speaker rose to seek recognition. Weary, haggard, and unshaven senators slumped despondently in their chairs after the rigors of an all-night session, uttered, "Vote! Vote!" in the hopes of discouraging any further oratory on a bill already certain of passage. But Senator Sam Houston of Texas, the hero of San Jacinto, was not so easily discouraged by overwhelming odds. The bill on which bitter and exhausting debate now closed was known as the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, the new unity device of the Democratic Party and the latest concession to the South. It repealed the Missouri Compromise of 1820 and reopened the slavery extension issue, thought settled in the Compromise of 1850, by permitting the residents of that vast territory from Iowa to the Rockies to decide the slavery question for themselves on the assumption that the northern part of the territory would be free and the southern part slave. For Democrats and Southerners, this bill had become must legislation. Sam Houston was a Democrat of long standing, and Sam Houston was a Southerner by birth, residence, loyalty, and philosophy. But Sam Houston was also Sam Houston, one of the most independent, unique, popular, forceful, and dramatic individuals ever to enter the Senate chamber. The first senator from Texas, his name had long before been a household word as commander-in-chief of those straggling and undermanned Texas volunteers who routed the entire Mexican army at San Jacinto, captured its general, and established the independence of Texas. He had been acclaimed as the first president of the Independent Republic of Texas, a member of her Congress, and president again before the admission of Texas into the Union as a state. He was no easy mark at the age of 64, and neither sectional nor party ties were enough to seal his lips. Sam Houston looked upon the Missouri Compromise as a solemn and sacred compact between North and South. Nor was he willing to discard the Compromise of 1850, which he had supported despite the enmity of Texas fire-eaters who called his vote the damnedest outrage yet committed upon Texas. With rugged but earnest eloquence, he begged his weary colleagues in an impromptu plea not to plunge the nation into new agitations over the slavery issue. Sam Houston must have known the bill would pass. He must have known that not a single other Southern Democrat would join him. He must have known that, as rumor of his position had spread the previous week, the Richmond Inquirer had spoken for his constituents in declaring, "Nothing can justify this treachery, nor can anything save the traitor from the deep damnation that such treason may merit." It was, Houston was later to remark, "the most unpopular vote I ever gave, but the wisest and most patriotic." Certainly it was the most unpopular. Texas, with 150,000 valuable slaves and an overwhelmingly Democratic population consisting largely of citizens from other southern states, identified its interests with those Houston had attacked, and with near unanimity she cried for Houston's scalp as one who had betrayed his state in the Senate, joined the abolitionists, and deserted the South. By a vote of 73-3, the legislature condemned the stand of him who was once the most glorious hero the state had ever known. To make matters worse, this was not the first offense for Senator Sam Houston. He had tangled with John Calhoun on the Oregon question, describing himself as a Southerner for whom the Union was his guiding star. "I know neither North nor South. I know only the Union," Houston would say. He would have nothing to do, moreover, with Calhoun's hands-off slavery resolutions and Southern address, attacking that revered sage of the South for his long-cherished and ill-concealed designs against the Union. Finally, Houston had been the first prominent senator to attack Calhoun's opposition to the Clay Compromise of 1850. Thus, his lonely vote against the Kansas-Nebraska bill on that stormy dawn in 1854 was the last straw. It was loudly whispered about the Senate that this was the last term for the colorful general. Those illustrious senators with whom he had served, whose oratory could not attract the glory and romance which surrounded the name of Sam Houston, may have frowned upon his eccentric dress and his habit of whittling pine sticks on the Senate floor while muttering at the length of senatorial speeches, but they could not help but admire his stoical courage and rugged individualism, which his preface to a brief autobiographical sketch expressed more simply. "This book will lose me some friends, but if it lost me all and gained me none, in God's name, as I am a free man, I would publish it." The contradictions in the life of Sam Houston a century ago may seem irreconcilable today. No one can say with precision by what star Sam Houston steered, his own, Texas's, or the nation's. He was fiercely ambitious, yet at the end he sacrificed for principle all he had ever won or wanted. He was a Southerner, and yet he steadfastly maintained his loyalty to the Union. He was a slaveholder who defended the right of Northern ministers to petition Congress against slavery. He was a notorious drinker who took the vow of temperance. He was an adopted son of the Cherokee Indians who won his first military honors fighting the Creeks. He was a governor of Tennessee, but a senator from Texas. He was, in turn, magnanimous yet vindictive, affectionate yet cruel, faithful yet opportunistic. But Sam Houston's contradictions actually confirm his one basic, consistent quality, indomitable individualism, sometimes crude, sometimes mysterious, but always courageous. He could be all things to all men, and yet, when faced with his greatest challenge, he was faithful to himself and to Texas. The turmoil within Sam Houston was nothing more than the turmoil which racked the United States in those stormy years before the Civil War. The colorful uniqueness of Sam Houston was nothing more than the primitive expression of the frontier he had always known. When still a dreamy and unmanageable boy, he had run away from his Tennessee frontier home and was adopted by the Cherokee Indians. An infantry officer under Andrew Jackson in 1813, his right arm had been shredded by enemy bullets when he alone had dashed into enemy lines at the Battle of the Horseshoe. A natural actor with a strikingly handsome figure and a flair for picturesque dress and speech, He was a rapidly rising success in Tennessee as prosecuting attorney, congressman, and finally governor at 35. The story of his sudden resignation as governor at the height of a popularity which his friend Jackson hoped would make him Houston president is shrouded in mystery. Apparently, he discovered but a few days after his marriage that his young and beautiful bride had been forced to accept his hand by an ambitious father, when, in truth, she loved another. His mind and spirit shattered, Houston had abandoned civilization for the Cherokees, drunken debauchery, and political and personal exile. Several years later, his balance and purpose restored, General Jackson, to whom he was always faithful, sent him to Texas, where his fantastic military exploits became as much a part of American folklore as Valley Forge and Gettysburg. But neither adventure, adulation, nor a happy second marriage ever banished the inner sadness and melancholy which seemed to some in 1856, now that political defeat approached, more evident than ever. But Sam Houston was not one to sit morosely brooding until the whispers of impending defeat were replaced by the avalanche that would crush him. He struck out with one grand assault on Texas officialdom by announcing himself a candidate for governor in the 1857 election. He would not run as a Democrat, or as the candidate of any faction or newspaper, or even resign from the Senate. He would run as Sam Houston. To regenerate the politics of the state, the people want excitement, and I had as well give it as anyone. And plenty of excitement is what he provided. Frequently peeling off his shirt during the hot summer campaign, he harangued audiences in every corner of Texas with his great fund of vituperative epithets and withering sarcasm. He reveled in the exercise of the sharp tongue, which the dignities of the Senate chamber had largely stilled. But his votes on Kansas and other Southern measures could not be explained away to an angry constituency, and Texas handed Sam Houston the first trouncing of his political career. But Sam Houston, encouraged that the margin of defeat was no greater than 3-2, returned to Washington for his final years in the Senate, unshaken in his beliefs. On November 10, 1857, Sam Houston was unceremoniously dismissed by the Texas legislature and a more militant spokesman for the South elected as his successor. In bidding farewell to his fellow senators, Houston told his colleagues that he desired to retire with clean hands and a clean conscience. I wish no prouder epitaph to mark the board or slab that may lie upon my tomb than this. He loved his country, he was a patriot, he was devoted to the Union. If it is for this that I had suffered martyrdom, it is sufficient that I stand at quits with those who have wielded the sacrificial knife. But we cannot conclude our story of Sam Houston's political courage with his retirement from the Senate. Returning to his ranch in Texas, the ex-senator found he was unable to retire when the governor who had defeated him 2 years previously was threatening to lead the state into secession. So in the fall of 1859, the aging warrior again ran as an independent candidate for governor, again with no party, no newspaper, and no organization behind him, and making but one campaign speech. It was a bitter campaign, the Democrats and newspapers assailing Houston with acrimonious passion, reopening old charges of Houston's immorality and cowardice. But strangely enough, his personal following among his old comrades, disgust with the administration of his opponents, new popularity which Houston had acquired just prior to his retirement by his exposure on the Senate floor of a corrupt federal judge, and a surge of sentimental feeling toward him upon his return to his beloved Texas, all combined to elect Sam Houston governor in a complete reversal of his defeat 2 years earlier. It was the first setback for Southern extremists in a decade. The old Jacksonian nationalism which had motivated his entire career now faced its severest trial. Maintaining that the overwhelmingly hostile Democratic legislature did not truly represent the people, Governor Houston violated all precedent by delivering his inaugural address directly to the people from the steps of the Capitol, instead of before a joint session of the legislature. To an immense audience gathered on the Capitol grounds, Houston declared that he was governor of the people and not of any party, and that when Texas united her destiny with that of the United States, she entered not into the North or the South, her connection was not sectional, but national. When South Carolina invited Texas to send delegates to the Southern Convention to protest assaults upon the institution of slavery and upon the rights of the South, by skillful political maneuvers, Houston prevented acceptance of South Carolina's invitation. As sentiment grew overwhelmingly in favor of secession during the heated presidential campaign of 1860, Governor Houston could only implore his impatient constituents to wait and see what Mr. Lincoln's attitude would be if elected. But the fact that he had received a few unsolicited votes in the Republican convention as Lincoln's running mate furnished further ammunition to his enemies, and when the town of Henderson mysteriously burned in August, the governor could do nothing to prevent the wave of lynchings, vigilante committees, and angry sentiment which followed rumors of Negro uprisings and arson. Houston's speech in Waco denouncing secession was answered by the explosion of a keg of powder behind the hotel in which he slept unharmed. Abraham Lincoln was elected president, and immediately throughout Texas the Lone Star flag was hoisted in an atmosphere of excited and belligerent expectation. Houston's plea that Texas fight for her rights in the Union and for the sake of the Union fell on deaf ears. Governor Houston was shoved aside as a secessionist convention was called. Sam Houston, fighting desperately to hold on to the reins of government, called a special session of the state legislature, denouncing extremists both north and south, and insisting that he had not yet lost the hope that our rights can be maintained in the Union. If not, he maintained, independence is preferable to joining the Southern camp. But the secessionist convention leaders could not be stopped, and their headlong rush into secession was momentarily disturbed only by the surprise appearance of the governor they hated but feared. On the day the ordinance of secession was to be adopted, Sam Houston sat on the platform, grimly silent, his presence renewing the courage of those few friends of the Union who remained in the hall. When, encouraged by the magic of Houston's presence, James W. Throckmorton cast one of the 7 votes against secession, he was loudly and bitterly hissed, and rising in his place, he made the memorable reply, "When the rabble hiss, well may patriots tremble." But there were few who trembled as the ordinance was adopted and submitted to the people for their approval at the polls 1 month later. Immediately, the fighting ex-senator took the stump in a one-man campaign to keep Texas in the Union. Ugly crowds, stones, and denunciations as a traitor met him throughout the state. At Waco, his life was threatened. At Belton, an armed thug suddenly arose and started toward him. But old Sam Houston, looking him right in the eye, put each hand on his own pistols. "Ladies and gentlemen, keep your seats. It is nothing but a fice barking at the lion in his den." Now 70 years old, old Sam closed his tour in Galveston before a jeering and ugly mob. "Let me tell you what is coming," he cried. "You may, after the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of precious lives, win Southern independence, if God be not against you. But I doubt it. The North is determined to preserve this Union." His prophecy was unheeded. On February 23rd, Texas voted for secession by a large margin, and on March 2nd, the special convention reassembled at Austin, and by a thumping vote of 109-2, declared Texas to be a part of the Southern Confederacy, and decreed that all state officers must take the new oath of allegiance on the 14th of March. The governor's secretary merely replied that Governor Houston did not acknowledge the existence of the convention and should not regard its action as binding upon him. On March 14th, at the appointed hour, the convention clerk was instructed to call the roll of state officials. Silence settled over the vast audience, and every eye peered anxiously for a glimpse of the old hero. "Sam Houston!" There was no response. "Sam Houston! Sam Houston!" The rumbling and contemptuous voices began again. The office of Governor of Texas, Confederate States of America, was declared to be officially vacant, and Lieutenant Governor Edward Clark stepped up to take the oath. In another part of the Capitol, the hero of San Jacinto, casting aside a lifetime of political fortune, fame, and devotion from his people, was scrawling out his last message as governor with a broken heart. "Fellow citizens, in the name of your rights and liberty, which I believe have been trampled upon, I refuse to take this oath. In the name of my own conscience and my own manhood, I refuse to take this oath. I love Texas too well to bring civil strife and bloodshed upon her. I shall make no endeavor to maintain any authority as chief executive of this state except by the peaceful exercise of my function. I am stricken down because I will not yield those principles which I have fought for. The severest pang is that the blow comes in the name of the state of Texas. The time and the place. The end of the costly military struggle between North and South did not restore peace and unity on the political front. Appomattox had ended the shooting of brother by brother, but it did not halt the political invasions, the economic plundering, and the intersectional hatred that still racked a divided land. Those in the North who sought to bind up the wounds of the nation and treat the South with mercy and fairness, men like President Andrew Johnson and those senators who stood by him in his impeachment, were pilloried for their lack of patriotism by those who waved the bloody shirt. Those in the South who sought to demonstrate to the nation that the fanatical sectionalism of their region had been forgotten, men like Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus Lamar of Mississippi, were attacked by their constituents as deserters to the conquering enemy. When Confederate General Bob Toombs was asked why he did not petition Congress for his pardon, Toombs replied with quiet grandeur, "Pardon for what? I have not yet pardoned the North." But gradually the old conflicts over emancipation and reconstruction faded away, and exploitation of the newly opened West and the trampled South brought new issues and new faces to the Senate. It was no longer the forum for our greatest constitutional lawyers, for constitutional issues no longer dominated American public life. Easy money, sudden fortunes, increasingly powerful political machines, and blatant corruption transformed much of the nation, and the Senate, as befits a democratic legislative body, accurately represented the nation. Corporation lawyers and political bosses, not constitutional orators, were the spokesmen for this roaring era. 11 new states were added quickly as the West was developed, and 22 new senators and a tremendous new chamber detracted from that old, distinctive atmosphere. Senators, said William Allen White, represented not only states and regions, but principalities and powers and business. One senator, for instance, represented the Union Pacific Railway system, another the New York Central, still another the insurance interests. The collar of any great financial interest was worn in pride. And White related the supposed conversation which veteran Senator Davis described to a freshman senator, the characteristics of his colleagues in those roaring days as they came down the aisle. The jackal, the vulture, the sheep-killing dog, the gorilla, the crocodile, the buzzard, the old clucking hen, the dove, the turkey gobbler. Then White wrote, as the big hulk of a greedy Westerner, coarse, devious, insolent, came swinging in heavily, Judge Davis pointed his stubby forefinger at the creature and exclaimed, "A wolf, sir, a damned, hungry, skulking, cowardly wolf." Thus, by the end of the 19th century, the Senate had come to very nearly its lowest ebb in terms of power as well as prestige. But the Senate, despite its decline in power and public esteem during the second half of the 19th century, did not consist entirely of damned skulking wolves. It still contained men worthy of respect and men of courage. Of these, Edmund Ross and those who stood with him in the Johnson impeachment trial selflessly sacrificed themselves to save the nation from reckless abuse of legislative power. And Lucius Lamar, by his gentle but firm determination to be a statesman, was instrumental in reuniting the nation in preparation for the new challenges which lay ahead. Edmund G. Ross. In a lonely grave, forgotten and unknown, lies the man who saved a president, and who, as a result, may well have preserved for ourselves and posterity constitutional government in the United States. The man who performed in 1868 what one historian has called the most heroic act in American history, incomparably more difficult than any deed of valor upon the field of battle, but a United States senator whose name no one recalls, Edmund G. Ross of Kansas. The impeachment of President Andrew Johnson, the event in which the obscure Ross was to play such a dramatic role, was the sensational climax to the bitter struggle between the president, determined to carry out Abraham Lincoln's policies of reconciliation with the defeated South, and the more radical Republican leaders in Congress, who sought to administer the downtrodden Southern states as conquered provinces which had forfeited their rights under the Constitution. It was, moreover, a struggle between executive and legislative authority. By 1866, when Edmund Ross first came to the Senate, the two branches of the government were already at each other's throats, snarling and bristling with anger. Bill after bill was vetoed by the president on the grounds that they were unconstitutional, too harsh in their treatment of the South, an unnecessary prolongation of military rule in peacetime, or an undue interference with the authority of the executive branch. And for the first time in our nation's history, important public measures were passed over a president's veto and became law without his support. But not all of Andrew Johnson's vetoes were overturned, and the radical Republicans of the Congress promptly realized that one final step was necessary before they could crush their despised foe. And in the heat of political battle, their vengeance was turned upon their president far more than their former military enemies of the South. That one remaining step was the assurance of a two-thirds majority in the Senate. For under the Constitution, such a majority was necessary to override a presidential veto. And more important, such a majority was constitutionally required to accomplish their major ambition, now an ill-kept secret: conviction of the president under an impeachment and his dismissal from office. The temporary and unstable two-thirds majority, which had enabled the Senate radical Republicans on several occasions to enact legislation over the president's veto, was, they knew, insufficiently reliable for an impeachment conviction. To solidify this bloc became the paramount goal of Congress, expressly or impliedly governing its decisions on other issues, particularly the admission of new states, the readmission of Southern states, and the determination of senatorial credentials. By extremely dubious methods, a pro-Johnson senator was denied his seat. Over the president's veto, Nebraska was admitted to the Union, seating two more anti-administration senators. Although last-minute maneuvers failed to admit Colorado over the president's veto — sparsely populated Colorado had rejected statehood in a referendum — an unexpected tragedy brought false tears and fresh hopes for a new vote in Kansas. Senator Jim Lane of Kansas had been a conservative Republican, sympathetic to Johnson's plans to carry out Lincoln's Reconstruction policies. But his frontier state was one of the most radical in the Union. When Lane voted to uphold Johnson's veto of the Civil Rights Bill of 1866 and introduce the administration's bill for recognition of the new state government of Arkansas, Kansas had arisen in outraged heat. A mass meeting at Lawrence had vilified the senator and speedily reported resolutions sharply condemning his position. Humiliated, mentally ailing, broken in health, and laboring under charges of financial irregularities, Jim Lane took his own life on July 1, 1866. With this thorn in their side removed, the radical Republicans in Washington looked anxiously toward Kansas and the selection of Lane's successor. Their fondest hopes were realized, for the new senator from Kansas turned out to be Edmund G. Ross, the very man who had introduced the resolutions attacking Lane at Lawrence. There could be no doubt as to where Ross's sympathies lay, for his entire career was one of determined opposition to the slave states of the South, their practices, and their friends. In 1854, when only 28, he had taken part in the mob rescue of a fugitive slave in Milwaukee. In 1856, he had joined that flood of anti-slavery immigrants to Bleeding Kansas, who intended to keep it a free territory. Disgusted with the Democratic Party of his youth, he had left that party and volunteered in the Kansas Free State Army to drive back a force of pro-slavery men invading the territory. In 1862, he had given up his newspaper work to enlist in the Union Army, from which he emerged as a major. His leading role in the condemnation of Lane at Lawrence convinced the radical Republican leaders in Congress that in Edmund G. Ross they had a solid member of that vital two-thirds. The stage was now set for the final scene, the removal of Johnson. Early in 1867, Congress enacted over the president's veto the Tenure of Office Bill, which prevented the president from removing, without the consent of the Senate, all new office holders whose appointment required confirmation by that body. At the time, nothing more than the cry for more patronage was involved, cabinet members having originally been specifically exempt. On August 5, 1867, President Johnson, convinced that the Secretary of War, whom he had inherited from Lincoln, Edwin M. Stanton, was the surreptitious tool of the radical Republicans and was seeking to become the almighty dictator of the conquered South, asked for his immediate resignation, and Stanton arrogantly fired back the reply that he declined to resign before the next meeting of Congress. Not one to cower before this kind of effrontery, the president 1 week later suspended Stanton and appointed in his place the one man whom Stanton did not dare resist, General Grant. On January 13, 1868, an angry Senate notified the president and Grant that it did not concur in the suspension of Stanton, and Grant vacated the office upon Stanton's return. But the situation was intolerable. The Secretary of War was unable to attend cabinet meetings or associate with his colleagues in the administration. And on February 21st, President Johnson, anxious to obtain a court test of the act he believed obviously unconstitutional, again notified Stanton that he had been summarily removed from the office of Secretary of War. While Stanton, refusing to yield possession, barricaded himself in his office, public opinion in the nation ran heavily against the president. He had intentionally broken the law and dictatorially thwarted the will of Congress. Although previous resolutions of impeachment had been defeated in the House, both in committee and on the floor, a new resolution was swiftly reported and adopted on February 24th by a tremendous vote. Every single Republican voted in the affirmative, and Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, the fanatical personification of the extremes of the radical Republican movement, warned both houses of the Congress coldly, "Let me see the recreant who would vote to let such a criminal escape. Point me to one who will dare to do it, and I will show you one who will dare the infamy of posterity." With the president impeached, in effect, indicted by the House, the frenzied trial for his conviction or acquittal under the Articles of Impeachment began on March 5th in the Senate, presided over by the Chief Justice. It was a trial to rank with all the great trials in history, but two great elements of drama were missing. The actual cause for which the president was being tried was not fundamental to the welfare of the nation, and the defendant himself was at all times absent. But every other element of the highest courtroom drama was present. The chief prosecutor for the House was General Benjamin F. Butler, the Butcher of New Orleans, a talented but coarse and demagogic congressman from Massachusetts. When he lost his seat in 1874, he was so hated by his own party as well as his opponents that one Republican wired concerning the Democratic sweep, "Butler defeated, everything else lost." Some 1,000 tickets were printed for admission to the Senate galleries during the trial, and every conceivable device was used to obtain one of the four tickets allotted each senator. From the 5th of March to the 16th of May, the drama continued. Of the 11 articles of impeachment adopted by the House, the first eight were based upon the removal of Stanton and the appointment of a new Secretary of War in violation of the Tenure of Office Act. The ninth related to Johnson's conversation with a general, which was said to induce violations of the Army Appropriations Act. The tenth recited that Johnson had delivered intemperate, inflammatory, and scandalous harangues, as well against Congress as the laws of the United States. And the 11th was a deliberately obscure conglomeration of all the charges in the preceding articles, which had been designed by Thaddeus Stevens to furnish a common ground for those who favored conviction but were unwilling to identify themselves on basic issues. In opposition to Butler's inflammatory arguments in support of this hastily drawn indictment, Johnson's able and learned counsel replied with considerable effectiveness. They insisted that the Tenure of Office Act was null and void as a clear violation of the Constitution, that even if it were valid, it would not apply to Stanton for the reasons previously mentioned, and that the only way that a judicial test of the law could be obtained was for Stanton to be dismissed and sue for his rights in the courts. But as the trial progressed, it became increasingly apparent that the impatient Republicans did not intend to give the president a fair trial on the formal issues upon which the impeachment was drawn, but intended instead to depose him from the White House on any grounds, real or imagined, for refusing to accept their policies. Telling evidence in the president's favor was arbitrarily excluded. Prejudgment on the part of most senators was brazenly announced. Attempted bribery and other forms of pressures were rampant. The chief interest was not on the trial or the evidence, but in the tallying of votes necessary for conviction. 27 states, including the unrecognized southern states, in the Union meant 54 members of the Senate, and 36 votes were required to constitute the two-thirds majority necessary for conviction. All 12 Democratic votes were obviously lost, and the 42 Republicans knew that they could afford to lose only 6 of their own members if Johnson were to be ousted. To their dismay, at a preliminary Republican caucus, 6 courageous Republicans indicated that the evidence so far introduced was not, in their opinion, sufficient to convict Johnson under the Articles of Impeachment. "Infamy!" cried the Philadelphia Press. "The Republic has been betrayed in the house of its friends." But if the remaining 36 Republicans would hold, there would be no doubt as to the outcome. All must stand together. But one Republican senator would not announce his verdict in the preliminary poll, Edmund G. Ross of Kansas. The radicals were outraged that a senator from such an anti-Johnson stronghold as Kansas could be doubtful. "It was a very clear case," Senator Sumner of Massachusetts fumed, "especially for a Kansas man. I did not think that a Kansas man could quibble against his country." From the very time Ross had taken his seat, the radical leaders had been confident of his vote. He had made it clear that he was not in sympathy with Andrew Johnson personally or politically. And after the removal of Stanton, he had voted with the majority in adopting a resolution declaring such removal unlawful. His colleague from Kansas, Senator Pomeroy, was one of the most radical leaders of the anti-Johnson group. The Republicans insisted that Ross's crucial vote was rightfully theirs, and they were determined to get it by whatever means available. When the impeachment resolution had passed the House, Senator Ross had casually remarked to Senator Sprague of Rhode Island, "Well, Sprague, the thing is here, and, so far as I am concerned, though a Republican and opposed to Mr. Johnson and his policy, he shall have as fair a trial as an accused man ever had on this earth." Immediately the word spread that Ross was shaky. "From that hour," he later wrote, "not a day passed that did not bring me by mail and telegraph and in personal intercourse appeals to stand fast for impeachment." Ross and his fellow doubtful Republicans were daily pestered, spied upon, and subjected to every form of pressure. Their residences were carefully watched, their social circles suspiciously scrutinized, and their every move and companion secretly marked in special notebooks. They were warned in the party press, harangued by their constituents, and set dire warnings threatening political ostracism and even assassination. Stanton himself, from his barricaded headquarters in the War Department, worked day and night to bring to bear upon the doubtful senators all the weight of his impressive military associations. The Philadelphia Press reported a fearful avalanche of telegrams from every section of the country, a great surge of public opinion from the common people who had given their money and lives to the country and would not willingly or unavenged see their great sacrifice made naught. A member of the Kansas legislature called upon Ross at the Capitol. A general urged on by Stanton remained at his lodge until 4 o'clock in the morning, determined to see him. His brother received a letter offering $20,000 for revelations of the senator's intentions. Gruff Ben Butler exclaimed of Ross, "There's a bushel of money. How much does the damned scoundrel want?" The night before the Senate was to take its first vote for the conviction or acquittal of Johnson, Ross received this telegram from home. "Kansas has heard the evidence and demands the conviction of the president." Signed, D.R. Anthony and 1,000 others. And on that fateful morning of May 16th, Ross replied, "To D.R. Anthony and 1,000 others, I do not recognize your right to demand that I vote either for or against conviction. I have taken an oath to do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, and trust that I shall have the courage to vote according to the dictates of my judgment and for the highest good of the country." Signed, E.G. Ross. That morning, spies traced Ross to his breakfast, and 10 minutes before the vote was taken, his Kansas colleague warned him in the presence of Thaddeus Stevens that a vote for acquittal would mean trumped-up charges and his political death. But now the fateful hour was at hand. Every senator was in his seat, the desperately ill Grimes of Iowa being literally carried in. The voting tensely commenced. By the time the Chief Justice reached the name of Edmund Ross, 24 guilties had been pronounced. 10 more were certain and one other practically certain. Only Ross's vote was needed to obtain the 36 votes necessary to convict the president. But not a single person in the room knew how this young Kansan would vote. Unable to conceal the suspense and emotion in his voice, the Chief Justice put the question to him. "Mr. Senator Ross, how say you? Is the respondent Andrew Johnson guilty or not guilty of a high misdemeanor as charged in this article?" Every voice was still. Every eye was upon the freshman senator from Kansas. The hopes and fears, the hatred and bitterness of past decades were centered upon this one man. As Ross himself later described it, every fan was folded, not a foot moved, not the rustle of a garment, not a whisper was heard. Hope and fear seemed blended in every face, instantaneously alternating, some with revengeful hate, others lighted with hope. The senators in their seats leaned over their desks, many with hand to ear. It was a tremendous responsibility. And it was not strange that he upon whom it had been imposed by a fateful combination of conditions should have sought to avoid it, to put it away from him as one shuns or tries to fight off a nightmare. I almost literally looked down into my open grave. Friendships, position, fortune, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by the breath of my mouth, perhaps forever. It is not strange that my answer was carried waveringly over the air and failed to reach the limits of the audience, or that repetition was called for by distant senators on the opposite side of the chamber. Then came the answer again in a voice that could not be misunderstood. Full, final, definite, unhesitating and unmistakable. Not guilty. The deed was done. The president saved. The trial as good as over and the conviction lost. The remainder of the roll call was unimportant. Conviction had failed by the margin of a single vote, and a general rumbling filled the chamber until the Chief Justice proclaimed that on this article, 35 senators having voted guilty and 19 not guilty, a two-thirds majority not having voted for conviction, the president is, therefore, acquitted under this article. A 10-day recess followed, 10 turbulent days to change votes on the remaining articles. An attempt was made to rush through bills to readmit 6 southern states whose 12 senators were guaranteed to vote for conviction. But this could not be accomplished in time. Again, Ross was the only one uncommitted on the other articles, the only one whose vote could not be predicted in advance. And again, he was subjected to terrible pressure. From D.R. Anthony and others, he received a wire informing him that Kansas repudiates you as she does all perjurers and skunks. Every incident in his life was examined and distorted. Professional witnesses were found by Senator Pomeroy to testify before a special House committee that Ross had indicated a willingness to change his vote for a consideration. Unfortunately, this witness was so delighted in his exciting role that he also swore that Senator Pomeroy had made an offer to produce 3 votes for an acquittal for $40,000. When Ross, in his capacity as a committee chairman, took several bills to the president, James G. Blaine remarked, "There goes the rascal to get his pay." Long afterward, Blaine was to admit, in the exaggerated denunciation caused by the anger and chagrin of the moment, great injustice was done to statesmen of spotless character. Again, the wild rumor spread that Ross had been won over on the remaining articles of impeachment. As the Senate reassembled, he was the only one of the 7 renegade Republicans to vote with the majority on preliminary procedural matters. But when the 2nd and 3rd articles of impeachment were read, and the name of Ross was reached again with the same intense suspense of 10 days earlier, again came the calm answer, not guilty. Why did Ross, whose dislike for Johnson continued, vote not guilty? His motives appear clearly from his own writings on the subject years later, in articles contributed to Scribner's and Forum magazines. In a large sense, the independence of the executive office as a coordinate branch of the government was on trial. If the president must step down, a disgraced man and a political outcast, upon insufficient proofs and from partisan considerations, the office of the president would be degraded, cease to be a coordinate branch of the government, and ever after subordinated to the legislative will. The open grave which Edmund Ross had foreseen was hardly an exaggeration. A justice of the Kansas Supreme Court telegraphed him that the rope with which Judas Iscariot hanged himself is lost, but Jim Lane's pistol is at your service. An editorial in a Kansas newspaper screamed, on Saturday last, Edmund G. Ross, United States Senator from Kansas, sold himself and betrayed his constituents, stultified his own record, basely lied to his friends, shamefully violated his solemn pledge, and to the utmost of his poor ability signed the death warrant of his country's liberty. This act was done deliberately, because the traitor, like Benedict Arnold, loved money better than he did principle, friends, honor, and his country all combined. Poor, pitiful, shriveled wretch, with a soul so small that a little pelf would outweigh all things else that dignify or ennoble manhood. Ross's political career was ended. Comparative peace returned to Washington as Stanton relinquished his office and Johnson served out the rest of his term. Later, unlike his Republican defenders, to return triumphantly to the Senate as a senator from Tennessee. But no one paid attention when Ross tried unsuccessfully to explain his vote. He clung unhappily to a seat in the Senate until the expiration of his term, frequently referred to as the traitor Ross, and complaining that his fellow congressmen, as well as citizens on the street, considered association with him disreputable and scandalous, and passed him by as if he were a leper with averted face and every indication of hatred and disgust. Neither Ross nor any other Republican who had voted for the acquittal of Johnson was ever reelected to the Senate, not a one of them retaining the support of their party's organization. When he returned to Kansas in 1871, he and his family suffered social ostracism, physical attack, and near poverty. Who was Edmund G. Ross? Practically nobody. Not a single public law bears his name. Not a single history book includes his picture. Not a single list of Senate greats mentions his service. His one heroic deed has all but been forgotten. But who might Edmund G. Ross have been? That is the question. For Ross, a man with an excellent command of words, an excellent background for politics, and an excellent future in the Senate, might well have outstripped his colleagues in prestige and power throughout a long Senate career. Instead, he chose to throw all of this away for one act of conscience. But the twisting course of human events eventually upheld the faith he expressed to his wife shortly after the trial. Millions of men cursing me today will bless me tomorrow for having saved the country from the greatest peril through which it has ever passed, though none but God can ever know the struggle it has cost me. For 20 years later, Congress repealed the Tenure of Office Act, to which every president after Johnson, regardless of party, had objected, and still later the Supreme Court, referring to the extremes of that episode in our government, held it to be unconstitutional. Ross moved to New Mexico, where, in his later years, he was to be appointed territorial governor. Just prior to his death, when he was awarded a special pension by Congress for his service in the Civil War, the press and the country took the opportunity to pay tribute to his fidelity to principle in a trying hour, and his courage in saving his government from a devastating reign of terror. They now agreed with Ross's earlier judgment that his vote had saved the country from a strain that would have wrecked any other form of government. Those Kansas newspapers and political leaders who had bitterly denounced him in earlier years praised Ross for his stand against legislative mob rule. By the firmness and courage of Senator Ross, it was said, the country was saved from calamity greater than war, while it consigned him to a political martyrdom, the most cruel in our history. Ross was the victim of a wild flame of intolerance which swept everything before it. He did his duty, knowing that it meant his political death. It was a brave thing for Ross to do, but Ross did it. He acted for his conscience and with a lofty patriotism, regardless of what he knew must be the ruinous consequences to himself. He acted right. Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus Lamar. No one had ever